This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. A warning that this episode contains discussion of sexual violence and abuse, and discussion of suicidal feelings which you may find distressing. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
In the cult, there wasn't just physical and sexual abuse. There was, you know, you're talking about entire childhood of psychological and emotional abuse as well. Mm. And for a lot of ex-members, sadly, a lot turned to addictions. And a lot of us suffer with depression, with PTSD. And sadly, you know, we've lost a lot of ex-SGAs, so my peers, to suicide.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Extraordinary Lives, the podcast from Lad Bible. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and today we're joined by Natasha Tormey. Natasha, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
For anyone who isn't aware of who you are, would you mind giving a brief introduction?
Sure. So my name's Natasha Tormey. I'm the author of Born into a Children of God, a book in which I detail my upbringing in the notorious sect, the Children of God, which is now known as the Family International. It's a cult that existed throughout the 70s, 80s, and still exists to this day, and in which there was quite a bit of scandalous doctrines involved, and which resulted in the mistreatment of many people, including children.
During the course of this conversation, we're going to talk about some quite upsetting topics, I imagine. Please do just let me know if there's any point that you want to pause or stop.
Sure.
Okay, fantastic. So thanks so much for coming in today. And I suppose let's get back to the very beginning of your story, because you were born into the cult, weren't you?
Yeah. So the cult was founded originally in 1968 by an American evangelical pastor called David Berg. So he started in the US, but it very quickly spread into Europe and then the rest of the world. So you had the original members who joined. Most of them were very young adults, 17, 18, early 20s at the start. And then as time went on, they went on to have children, who we call the second generation adults, SGAs, who were all born into the cult. So the big difference is that these SGAs knew nothing else about the outside world. They were really, from their date of birth, immersed into this very strange lifestyle, kind of kept in a bubble for their childhoods. So I was born into it in the early 80s and, well, remained into it until I could legally leave at age 18.
So it's quite an interesting story there where you say that, so David Berg, the founder, he was American, that's correct.
Yeah.
And then you said it quickly spread into Europe. So how are you aware? How does something like that happen? How does somebody start a cult somewhere in America and then for that to be able to spread into different areas of the globe?
So already Berg felt like an outcast in the Christian community. His mother was a very famous evangelical preacher, and he thought he was going to have the same sort of success, except that he had very... he had a bit more radical views on Christianity and how Christians should be living. So he was rejected very much by the mainstream Christian groups, which is when he had the idea to start the cult. But even then, he started to get a lot of negative attention from the press, from parents of people who had joined the cult, who had kind of gone off the radar, and they had big concerns about what was going on. So that's when he decided, well, America is an evil place, you know, let's go. Let's go to Europe and see if they'll accept us more there. And then the same thing kind of happened in Europe too, where before long they got some bad press and some concerns were raised. So then it was, let's go east. Let's go into Asia, into South America, into Africa.
Wow. So he was basically running away from the negative press around the globe. And
pretty much. So in the cult's height, they were very, very active, predominantly in Asia, South America, countries where they could get away with things.
Okay, okay. And what defines a cult? You know, what's the difference? If somebody says, oh, I'm going to just start, I'm in a small town, there's not many churches, I'm going to start practicing Christianity in a community center with a group of people. What's the tipping point when something can be defined as a cult?
Well, I think it's the main thing is a level of control. And generally, it's control of over multiple factors of a person's life. So often it will start with the control of their finances. So in the cult, in our cult, you know, everyone gave up all their money to the cult when they joined and everything was shared. No one had their own finances, so to speak. And then there's a level of control over lifestyle when it becomes to a point where you're being told how to live. Of course, in our cult, that became very extreme, as I'm sure we'll discuss later. A control over reproduction, a control over your working life. I think spiritually as well, psychological control obviously comes into play too. And when it gets to that point where the movement is controlling the person to such an extent that they don't have any freedom left, I think we can clearly call that a cult.
And then, okay, so to go back to your story, what are your first memories of, because you were born into the cult, you didn't choose to join it. So I guess the beginning of your life was, that's all you knew. You know, what were your first memories of it?
It's very difficult to explain it because that was all we knew. We didn't know anything else. So for us, for many years growing up, I think we just believed everyone lived like this. We didn't really realize that we were different and that we were being brought up in a very strange way. I think the older you get, it's like a slow recognition starts to come into play where you start thinking, well, why aren't we allowed to leave the house when we want? Why aren't we going to school like other children out there? And little things like that, you know, they start to add up. You know, why do I feel anxious all the time? Why do I feel scared? And I think in the back of your head, there's something in human nature where you know something's wrong, even at a very, very young age, but you just don't know what it is because no one's telling you.
But so can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of your life, you know, when you're born, you know, which country are you in? What does your family look like at that point? Where are you living? Like, is it a compound? Is it a house on a street? You know, just explain to anyone who isn't aware what your life was like at that point.
So it's important to note, it's like the frog in boiling water scenario. The cult didn't just start out with these drastic doctrines and things like that. It was a very slow, you know, curve over time. That being said, it was only over probably a decade, so not that slow. So my parents joined in France. Contraception was banned in the cult at this time and for a long time after that. So they had four kids very quickly, four boys, and then they went on to have me.
Wow.
So I was born in Thailand. They had just moved to Thailand when I was born. And I was raised in several compounds. So we moved a lot in the cult. Again, things had changed very drastically from the early days. Things were becoming quite extreme when I was growing up. So we lived in many compounds. We usually moved every 2 years or every year even. And these compounds were very big houses, usually a collection of buildings sometimes, where you could have 100, 150 people living in it. So they very much operated a bit like an army camp, so to speak, or a boarding school army camp, a bit of the both, in the sense that everyone lived like one commune. There was no individual families. So that's one thing cults often do. They'll break down the family unit. Because if you can't trust your own family and you can't unite with your own family, all your trust is going to the leader.
So as a child, were your parents clearly your parents, or was it like the other adults in that area were also given the task of raising you in a way?
Yeah, so you knew who your parents were, but everyone was your parent. So all the other adults you would call uncle and auntie. And they had as much right to discipline you as anyone else, to tell you what to do, etc. So because we're so many children, about 60 to 70% of the population at its height was children.
Wow.
Because contraception was banned.
Sure, yeah.
So we were put in straight away, you know, put into groups by age range. So you'd have the nursery group, you'd have the young children, the middle children, the older children. So you were raised in these groups with a teacher, which was any uncle or auntie from that commune that was assigned to your group. So they would be with you all day. They'd often sleep with you as well at night in the same room. So you're kind of raised in that kind of environment where there was no like individual family. You'd see your family only once a week on the Sunday. The rest of the time you were permanently in this group, separated from your parents, separated from your siblings, and kind of raised in this boarding school type environment, which, you know, I always say was for me, a very, very sad upbringing because there were so many people around you, but you were so lonely.
So what was it that made you lonely? If you're saying you were surrounded by a load of people and actually you had more access to adults that were in a sort of educational and parental role, what was making you feel lonely?
Well, firstly, you couldn't trust anyone. So you learned very quickly that you couldn't trust the adults, and you definitely could not trust your peers. So they created this environment of reporting on each other. Oh. You know, your only loyalty was to God, Jesus, the cult leader, the shepherds of the home. That was it. And your teacher of your group. So if another kid did something wrong, you had to go report on them, say what they did. They'd get badly punished for it. Yeah, and there was just this environment of high anxiety and stress and complete distrust of each other, even at a very young age, which is pretty sad because, you know, you're separated from your siblings. They'll be in different age groups than you're in. You're not seeing your parents hardly ever. And then you've got that kind of environment you're in 24 hours a day. So I just remember being very anxious as a child.
And why was it happening? Like, what was David Berg trying to achieve? Why did he want to set up this cult and create all these rules and separate the children and make, you know, what was he trying to do?
Well, it's all about control. So he, when I was growing up, was when the doctrines were at their worst, their most extreme, I would say. But he believed that it was his job. He was the prophet of the end, a reincarnation of the prophet Moses, and that the cult's job was to raise an end time army. So that's what we were.
Wow. Okay.
We were being raised to be soldiers for God in the last 7 years of the earth, which Christians call the end time, which is when the Antichrist comes in and tries to eradicate all Christians and kill them off. So we were being trained to fulfill this great destiny, which again was a lot of pressure growing up as a kid. But we had constant psychological training, doctrine training, you know, a lot of reading Berg's publications, memorizing his words, etc. We had practical training as well, how to survive in, you know, forests.
So he thought this would be like a genuine sort of apocalyptic fight.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow, so you'd be out there.
We were told, you know, we would be on the run for at least 3.5 of those 7 years. And he predicted dates too. So he predicted several. But I remember one key date he had predicted was 93. And that's when, you know, the Jesus was going to come back and all that. So I was expecting to die around the age of 10, 12, because we were told, you know, God, most of us were going to be murdered as martyrs for God. And we kind of had to just accept that fate.
And was he, because quite often with these kind of people, the Antichrist is then used as a way of describing types of people that already exist on Earth. Was he like that, or was he actually saying like there'll be devils and monsters reappearing that you have to fight with?
The Antichrist for him was an actual man.
Right.
Who was going to take over the world in its entirety. And he was going to exert full control over everything. He was going to ban all religions. He was going to make everyone have a chip in their forehead or their hand, you know, and just have full control over everything. And it was our job to fight him and his armies.
And how were you fighting him? Like weapons, guns? You know, what was the fighting?
Well, we were supposed to get superpowers.
Okay.
So there was supposed to be a point in the end time where we would receive superpowers from God, be that, you know, we could do lightning bolts from our fingers or throw fire through our eyes.
Is he getting that from verses in the Bible, or did he just start to invent things?
He based a lot of his stuff on things from the Book of Revelations, but obviously he also received most of his information through his gift of prophecy, which is hearing directly from God. Now, of course, we didn't know until much later that he was a raging alcoholic. So,
okay.
Yeah, a lot of his rants were under heavy influence of alcohol.
Okay. Okay. So I guess let's go back to so you're born in Thailand, and how long did you stay there for?
So we stayed in Thailand about 10 years in many different communes. We then moved on to Malaysia for a couple of years, Indonesia for a year, and finally back to France and bounced to Reunion Island and a bit everywhere.
And where so is he buying these communes? Is he creating or is he renting space? You know, where's the money coming from to generate the ability to move whole groups of people around the world?
So there are several sources of income, depending on the period of time it was in. At the very start, a lot of their income came from incoming members, because when you joined, you gave everything. If you had inheritance, that inheritance went to the cult.
Wow.
After that, they did a lot of selling, you know, posters and things. They did a lot with music. They had in France, for example, in the 70s, they had a very famous dance and singing group called Les Enfants de Dieu, the Children of God in French. And they were actually on TV and everything.
And they were cult members?
Yeah.
Wow. And they were just like a pop group.
Super popular, yeah. Later on in Thailand, for example, they had a lot of very big dance troupes and stuff, and some of their singers became very famous. They didn't always use, you know, the Family International. They would use a lot of other names, depending on which country they were in.
So at this point at the beginning, it was called the Children of God, right?
Yeah.
And that name had maintained through your childhood, is that right?
No, there was a point, it was probably around the time I was born, I don't know the exact date, but there was a point where they changed to the Family of Love and very quickly to the Family International. So again, all of this was part of the, you know, escaping bad reputations.
Yeah.
You know, no, we're not the Children of God. We're not. We're the Family International.
Right.
We're a completely different cult. We disbanded the Children of God, but it was all the same people.
Right, okay.
You know, it was they were quite savvy in that way, and they became even more savvy with time, where legally they knew exactly how to twist things and slip out. And
when you're moving around the world like that, so when you move to Thailand, are you picking up Thai members, or is it like the same kind of group of people moving around? You know, were you collecting different nationalities of people as you went?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very multicultural place, so we had a lot, there were quite a few Thai nationals who joined as well. But from a fundraising point of view, so you had a period where a lot of the fundraising then started to come from flirty fishing, which is one of the most scandalous doctrines that the cult is most well known for.
Okay.
So that began again, you know, nothing just happens overnight. It's always small suggestions that lead to other things. So it started off with David Berg believing that, well, first he introduced the law of love, which was a law, he said, anything was permissible if it was done in love, with love.
Oh, yeah. God.
You know where this is going.
Yeah.
So first, that very much affected adults. So there was a lot of sharing, they called it, that started happening. So this is over like 10 years. They went from being quite conservative, no sex before marriage, things like that. Then they said, actually, it's okay for people to have multiple wives or multiple husbands. So threesomes started happening. Then sharing started with the law of love. So that was the idea that to obtain full unity in the group, adults should share their partners with other adults that did not have a partner.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the idea that no one should be frustrated in that sense. Out of love, you should, you know, let your wife go and help out that lonely member over there who doesn't have a wife.
And they still have the no contraception rule.
Yeah.
Right.
But very quickly, that just went to complete extremes. It was not at all about single people anymore. It was everyone sleeping with everyone. Married, not married, orgies were happening. Sharing schedules were put up in some homes. Some homes where, you know, there was more control, the more radical communes, which are a lot of those in Thailand. So there'd be a schedule and the shepherds of the home would decide, tonight you're sharing with that person, you're sharing with that person. You know, so over, well, a year or two, it went from conservative to you don't even have a choice who you sleep with anymore.
So that feels fast to me, because to go from over the period of a year, to go from like conservative Christianity to basically the flip of what, you know, the way that most sort of conservative...
It may have been more than 2 years, but it certainly wasn't more than
But it feels like it's, you know, when you look at... He was American originally, and when you look at conservative American Christians, they're very much against that that way of life. And the fact that, you know, do you think that was because that was something he truly believed was the correct thing to do? Or do you think it was it's just something he wanted to do? You know, where was his thought process coming from, do you think?
I think he was, for lack of a better word, with all we know now about him, he was a sexual pervert, a complete deviant in that sense. You know, he used to get prophecies and dreams about sleeping with his own mother, you know. So I think a lot of it was about control. But then a lot of it was that he was fulfilling his own strange fantasies in some way. So during this big sexual revolution, as they called it, you know, he also requested that women send in striptease videos to him. And he would write these letters detailing exactly what he wanted them to do, you know. And I don't want you to show me everything straight away, you know. And in detailed instructions, so all the loads of women around the world and even, sadly, some children were sending in these dance videos to him.
This is Ben Powell Jones. We're just going to take a break from today's episode to talk about one of our sponsors, BetterHelp. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. How much time do you spend on yourself in an average week? So easy to get caught up in what everyone else needs from you and never take a moment to think about what you need from yourself. But when we spend all of our time giving, it can leave us feeling stretched thin and burned out. Therapy can give you the tools to find more balance in your life so you can keep supporting others without leaving yourself behind. Therapy is something I've used several times in my own life. I think sometimes we think it has to be for huge events or massive changes, but I like to just use it every couple of months or a couple of times a year, check in on myself. If anything's feeling like a struggle, book a few sessions, top myself back up. Visit betterhelp.com/minuteswith today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/minuteswith. Now back to the episode.
And this, at this point, this is still because God wants this to happen, because this is going to help us in the fight, or has it become something different?
Oh, that's still going on,
yeah.
The whole end time thing.
Yeah.
But this is all about unity and love. We are
right.
The family of love.
Okay.
So then sharing went a step further into flirty fishing. So then it, you know, Berg again slowly introduced it, saying, oh, my wife and I, Karen Zerbe, are doing this experiment where at night we're going to clubs and she's showing God's love to lonely businessmen who are there. Yeah. You know, and it started with, you know, just talking to them and dancing with them. And then very quickly the experiment went further and she was actually sleeping with them. And so it became, this is really successful for us. So, you know, we'd like you guys to start this too.
And the purpose was to recruit people to the cult? Or just to do it?
Well, at the beginning, yes. It was really about showing God's love and, you know, potentially trying to recruit someone to the cult. But, you know, demonstrating God's love in a physical way.
Right.
So, and then that, you know, was so successful that it became a means of fundraising. So it wasn't just flirty fishing. It was escorting services called ESing, where they were actually being paid as escorts as well and expecting donations in exchange for their time and whatever services they were providing. And, you know, you have to understand the concept of groupthink to understand how you can get to such an extreme. You know, and there were people who left along the way, but the majority stayed. And if you understand the way groupthink and psychological coercion work, then you understand why all these people stayed, because they were just in that environment where if you dared to go against it, you were an outcast.
And I guess at this point, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm imagining that the men weren't doing flirty fishing.
Yes, you know, they were.
They were.
So majority was women, because obviously
yes.
That was the more successful side of things. But yeah, the men would do it too.
So the doctrine at that point was that everyone had to go out to clubs and do their best to sleep with people in the hope of getting a donation for the cult.
Yeah, not everyone would. You know, there were some homes where they didn't like the practice as much as others, but certainly the more active and more dedicated communes, it was a big operation, basically. It was like a, you know, every night you had your core FFers or ESers that would go out and they'd be accompanied by some guys to, you know, for protection. And then you had the people who obviously weren't as successful at it as at it, be it because they just didn't have the looks for it, who would stay home and take care of things at home. Mm. But they, through FFing, flirty fishing, they met a lot of powerful people as well. Lawyers, politicians, members of the army, generals, things like that, who later would go on to protect them and, you know, shield them a little bit from when the rumors started coming out again and things like that in certain wow. countries. I mean, I know there were someone I lived with had a Arabic prince as well who was on her FFing schedule who would, you know, just give her handfuls of jewels.
God.
Yeah.
And what do you think what was the draw to an outsider to join a cult like that? Like, because what you're describing, you know, it sounds awful. You know, it sounds like no control over your life, no control over your finances or your home or your family. So if people are born into it, obviously, you know, no different. But if people are outside that looking in and get invited to join it, what's the draw for an adult to see that and go, okay, yeah, that seems like a positive way to live my life?
Well, firstly, they never showed that side to the world. Their facade that the public saw was so, so different. It was black and white. You know, to the outside, we looked like this really lovely group of people who were just trying to do good for God. You know, we did a lot of humanitarian work as well as part of our fronts. So from the outside, we looked like people who were really just there to help, you know, help people who were poor, help orphanages, schools, and things like that. But also, by the time all the extreme doctrines came out, they already had their core membership.
Okay.
They didn't recruit very much. From the time I was a very young child, I don't remember there being many incoming new recruits. It was quite rare. And if there were, it was more in places like Africa and things like that, where, you know, they weren't aware of what was maybe going on in the other more extreme communes of the cult. So, but then like they also didn't tell new recruits what was going on. You didn't join the cult and, hey, going to go flirty fishing tonight. There was a whole process to join the cult. You started off babe status, where you could only read certain documents that were very clean, called the milk of the word. And they slowly built you up to the meat of the word.
Okay.
Which was the more heavy duty stuff.
And that's the frog in the pan of hot water you described earlier, yeah. where you, as you developing, being part of this, going yeah. further into it. Okay, well, let's just go back a little bit to one of the more distressing aspects of that cult. There are quite widespread reports of child abuse within it.
Yeah.
Would you mind if we talk about that a little?
Sure.
Because with adults, there'll be huge brainwashing techniques going on, but they are adults. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with children who have less ability to make their own choices, it is more distressing. You know, can you tell us a little bit about that aspect of the cult?
Sadly, as part of the sexual revolution came also Berg's suggestion that children should be able to experience sexuality from a very, very young age. The way children were impacted was greatly affected by one particular book that was published. So you had Berg's letters that already started quite a wave. And it wasn't like pedophilia was happening out in the open or anything. But it basically gave permission and no rules for anyone who was that way inclined to go ahead and do it. And whether it was... There were some homes in which it was openly practiced. So I know there were some communes in Greece where it was open practice. Everyone knew it was happening. There were other homes like the homes in Thailand where I lived where it was happening. Maybe some people knew about it but didn't say anything. But it was happening and some knew, some didn't. It was kind of behind closed doors. But there was this one particular book that came out that was written by a woman called Sarah Keeley and co-written by Karen Zerbe, who's currently leader of the cult, called The Story of Davidito. So Davidito was a child Karen Zerbe had who was born as a result of FFing, flurry fishing. Mm. But David Berg had kind of taken him under his wing and adopted him as his son. And he was kind of being raised to be the next king of the cult, so to speak. And this book was all about the different ways they were experimenting with raising him, including, you know, some pretty disturbing detailed accounts and photographs of him being sexually molested when he was a toddler from the age of 1, 2 and onwards. So when that book came out, I mean, there are some adults in the cult who say they never took it as an instruction to abuse. They took it as a doctrine experiment. And there are others in the cult who really took it as this is what we're going to do now. So unfortunately, you know, because children don't always talk when they're abused, it wasn't until quite a bit later that I think we realized there was a lot more sexual abuse that happened than anyone could have imagined. Mm-hmm. And it was known at the time because there was a point where they had to put their foot down and say stop, because I think there were some instances where very young girls got pregnant. Then also came AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases. So flirty fishing had to stop. And then further down the line, they kind of said, okay, we need to stop. We need to ban any type of interaction with children because of all, you know, it was starting to get out. There were starting to be rumors and stuff. But before that, it was very much, it just went on. And after that, it went on as well, where they would issue a, you know, an official letter saying, anyone who does this, touches children, is going to be excommunicated. And then just behind that would come a bar letter, burn after reading. Guys, we've had to say this, and this happened all the time in the cult. We've had to issue this, you know, because the world doesn't understand our doctrines. God. They don't understand what we're trying to do. So yes, we need to stop doing it, but just to let you know that we stand behind our doctrines, you know, and we still believe there's nothing wrong with things that are done in love. So, you know, the mixed messaging.
So they'd send a letter like that, and then the adults would read it and then destroy it so that there wasn't evidence that they'd said,
yeah,
discard that previous one.
And there were so many documents that were destroyed. Luckily, some ex-members actually stole a trunk of them that hadn't been destroyed yet. And that's all the evidence that's online now. Without that, we would have no evidence, really.
And what happened to the boy that was being raised by the two cult founders?
Oh, that was extremely sad. So Davidito, who later was known as Ricky Rodriguez, he went against his mother at some point. After his father died, his mother took over. Even though he was being raised to be the next leader, he started traveling and listening to his peers and finding out all the abuse they went through as well. He went through terrible abuse too. And he tried to rebuild his life in the outside world, but he just didn't manage to get there. He was so haunted by everything that happened to him, and he felt some kind of responsibility because of his position in the cult. And he spent some time looking for his mother because he wanted to kill her. And instead, she's been living in hiding for decades. And instead, he found one of his nannies, one of the ones in the infamous book, who abused him. And he killed her and then killed himself.
Oh, my God.
It was absolutely tragic, but it was also a huge event that caused a lot of the younger generation to leave. Because then we thought, nah, if this is the child of the cult leader, you know, and things were so bad for him, you know, this was just crazy. We need to go.
And I do you mind me asking you about your experiences, because I know you had some deeply unpleasant experiences along the lines of what we've been discussing.
Yeah, sure. So I was sexually abused at the age of 4, multiple occasions over about a year. It was someone who was assigned, one of the uncles who was assigned to take care of my group of children. You know, these were people who had absolutely no childcare experience, and, you know, it was considered a lowly job as well. All the super smart, super popular people were the fundraisers and things like that. So it was kind of all the riffraff were put on child duty. But he was a Filipino member of the cult who It took advantage of his position, really. And I know that he did it to another girl, at least one other girl. And my father actually excommunicated him a few years later because he found out about the other girl. I didn't say anything till I was about 10. I don't know why. I just felt so dirty. It's just, you just didn't feel like you could trust anyone enough to tell as well. Because you could see sometimes someone would say something about someone touching them. And then they'd go and get their mouth washed out with soap, or they'd be put on silence restriction for a week. You know, you were punished and called liars all the time, so.
It must have been confusing too, because from what it sounds like, there was actually mixed messages whether it was actually a bad thing anyway. So as in when the people...
Well, that's it. And that was the main thing, is that you didn't know it was bad. No one ever told you. It is until much later, it's not okay for someone to touch you in that way or to do that to you. You know, so you had no idea. You were being told by this abuser that he was showing you God's love. But at the same time, you felt so sick to the stomach when it was happening and so just horrible and scared and disgusted. It was very, very confusing, especially when you're that young. You know, at age 4, you just don't have the mental capacity to deal with a situation like that.
So did your abuser remain in the cult for several years with you?
Yeah.
Yeah, until your father...
Well, thankfully, he was only in charge of our group for 1 year.
Okay.
So that put an end to it, at least, at some point. But then, yeah, my father found out he had done something to another girl, and he excommunicated him. But then, you know, it happened all the time. People were excommunicated, and then you'd go to another commune, and there they'd be.
Oh, really?
They were let back in because they'd repented.
Oh.
That happened a lot as well.
And I mean, you said that you became aware that something felt wrong about the cult. You know, like you say, you'd grown up there, you'd been raised in it, you're progressing through life. That's all you're told. And you said earlier that you're told that everyone else doesn't understand, the other Christians don't understand, they've turned away from the true word of God. What was the point in your life where you started to feel like something might not be everything that you've been told?
Oh, much later. I think it was only because the cult started having some legal issues around 93, 94, just around the time Berg died. There were raids that took place because there had been reports in several countries that there was a lot of child abuse going on in this cult. So the homes were raided by police and social services in certain countries. It was like a simultaneous raid across the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So like they'd all sort of communicate?
I believe so, because it was all around the same time. So there must have been some kind of coordination going on. So some homes in South America, Australia, France, none in Thailand, no. Yeah, I think that was it. England maybe as well. And that led to, there was a big court case going on at the same time in England though, with a custody, it started as a custody court case. There was a grandmother who was trying to get custody of her grandchild who was being raised in the cult, but it turned into the cult being on trial. So all of this media attention was happening. So they had to clean up their act at some point and they had to stop being so obvious and so, you know, standing out so much. So they ordered all the big communes to break down into smaller units and disperse type thing. So when we ended up in a smaller unit, we then moved back to France. It was kind of just my family. It's the first time we were alone as a family with just one or two other members passing through sometimes. So we started to have a little bit more access to the outside world because growing up, you know, in these big compounds, you never left the compound unless it was to go fundraise or to go renew your visa or for something specific, you know. You couldn't just interact with outsiders. That never happened. You were always being watched, being, you know, told what to say and things like that. So when we started being able to actually talk to outsiders is when, you know, we started to realize, I was a young teenager by then, this is, the way we live is just really weird.
Let me ask you a question there then. Just get a bit of detail. Can you explain how you lived? What was the day-to-day in the cult? You know, why was it weird? Why was it different to what somebody that was raised in France as an average teenager might experience?
Already was sort of military camp lifestyle. So you didn't leave the cult. You had your group. You were had school in your group. All of our schooling was cult-created. We had no access to outside music, wow. books, films. There were a handful of those that we could access, but they had been chosen by the cult because they fit the cult's doctrines. So, you know, on movies, for example, would be The Sound of Music and
right,
Jesus of Nazareth and biblical stories and things like that. But there were very, very, very few things that we could access. Everything, because they were very successful in creating their own content as well. They actually started media companies and created videos for children, music videos for children. They created all sorts of, you know, music tapes and videos and books, which they sold to outsiders as well, under different names, of course.
Mm.
Aurora Productions.
Right.
You know, so it didn't say it was specifically from the cult. And that was a big way they made money for a long time as well. And through their subsequent magazines too, which they still do now. So you kind of had this complete bubble. You know, everyone who came in and out, it was everything was controlled. There was no access to anything. And day to day was regimented on the minute. You know, you single file, march to your classroom for school time.
Oh, wow.
Single file to the canteen, you know, the big room with all the tables, because there were so many people. It was like...
And when you're going to the classroom for school time, are you studying maths, English, biology, or is it, you know, what kind of subjects?
You had the three R's, so reading, writing, arithmetic, and that was pretty much it.
Mm.
They taught science, as in their own version of science, you know, the biblical version, and all of Berg's opinion of what science was. They taught history in their way too. You know, their version of history or Berg's.
So was that like how, you know, when you say their science, was it no evolution, no dinosaurs?
Oh, like God, no.
Yeah.
The Earth is only 4,000 years old.
Right. Okay. That's science.
Yes. Yeah, so there was no curriculum, so to speak. It was really, you were studying what Berg had written in letters over the years. I mean, he wrote thousands upon thousands of letters over the time he was leader on every topic imaginable, from day to day, you know, every aspect of day to day life, down to how many pieces of toilet paper you could use. Oh yeah, that detailed, to how to raise your kids, obviously, to, you know, what kind of diet you should have, what kind of exercise you should be doing. It's really, really regimented.
And is that because he saying, because I'm just trying to understand, you know, why you, if someone tells you how many pieces of toilet paper to use, is it because he's saying God's told me that that's correct? Or is it at this point, is he just a charismatic leader of the people and they just think, well, he's
yes.
brilliant.
Yes, well, he was the father of the people. So every you know, it was really like, I care so much about you. I want to make sure you're really living the way we should be living according to God's standards.
Mm.
And the toilet paper one is one that comes up often because it's so ludicrous. Mm. But that was really about waste. You know, he hated waste. So he thought, you know, you could take three pieces of toilet paper and use it for seven different things before you threw it away. Yeah.
My God.
But yeah, it was really that controlled.
And how would, because he, as a leader, he must have been sort of charismatic. You know, did you ever meet him?
No, very few people met him.
Oh, really? So he wasn't standing
very
at the front
quickly,
of the commune?
From the beginning, when he left the States, it became his core leadership circle. And they went into hiding, and that was it. We didn't even see a photo of him until after his death. It was always a cartoon depiction of his face.
Wow. And then so he'd just be sending these letters out to everyone that the communes would, but you weren't, you know, he...
Well, this is one of the most incredible things about Berg. I'm not 100% sure, but I think he is the only cult leader who has ever managed to do that, to successfully maintain such a high level of control over, you know, 10 to 15,000 people without them ever meeting him, without them ever being in his presence. He was that charismatic through his words, and he had that level of control through his leadership team. So he lived in hiding for the majority of his life.
Yeah, because when we've been talking so far, I imagined that it was him moving to Thailand and saying, right, we're moving here now, setting it up, then him moving.
Oh, no, we were everywhere across the globe. Even in the West, which was evil, he still maintained smaller communes there. We were absolutely in every continent. And that was his aim, was to be, you know, international.
Hey, this is Ben Powell Jones. We're just taking a brief break so I can tell you about one of our sponsors, a brand new 6-part podcast from Message Heard and Podimo. Who Robs a Banksy follows journalist Jake Warren as he sets out to explore the stranger than fiction tale of the man who kidnapped a Banksy statue from the middle of central London in broad daylight and held it to ransom. The act would lead to an almost 20-year war of bad blood, relations, and legal battles that are still being waged today. And it all comes down to one man and one vendetta. But it doesn't end there. The story will take us on a journey through UK's most subversive subcultures, from art heists and art terrorists to 80s football hooliganism and the 90s illegal rave scene, even fetish parties. And throughout it all, Jake will be trying to get a hold of the most elusive and famed anonymous artist in the world. In the new 6-part series, host Jake Warren speaks to Tiger King of the art scene, Andy Link, and those closest to Banksy himself, exposing their 2-decade-long feud and attempting to track down the world's most elusive anonymous artist. Who Robs a Banksy is available now wherever you get podcasts. To hear the whole series ad-free, subscribe to Podimo UK on Apple Podcasts. Now back to our episode.
So when you see documentaries on cults and the brainwashing that goes on with the people that join them or that are born into them, it's usually by a couple of people who are very good at that, but it's usually face-to-face or mass groups. So how was he able to... Do you mind the term brainwashing? Is that an okay term to use?
That's fine.
How was he able to brainwash adults without any... When adults were joining, how was the cult able to... You know, we spoke earlier about the gradual slope into it, but I'm just trying to put myself in this position. Mm. How would they persuade me that my lifestyle was evil, I was doing the wrong thing? If I joined that cult, I'd be guaranteed, you know, a place in heaven or whatever it was. Like, what were the techniques they used if he wasn't there face to face?
Well, they were very good at recruiting. Firstly, everyone became very good at recruiting. They created this kind of on fire excitement in people, and they were very, very persuasive. But he led through his leadership team, which he changed often to make sure no one got too powerful.
Wow. Yeah.
There was a point in the height of the craziness where he just went, all you leaders are demoted. I'm putting a whole new structure into place. And they regularly restructured to make sure, you know,
that's crazy. So there wasn't even a group of people that were constant leaders. It was
some, yes, at the higher levels. So you had, you know, his wife Karen Zerbe, Peter Kelly, who's now her husband, her second husband. So you had some core people at the top that remained pretty constant, and he had his team around him, you know, quite a few followers who were there running his show. And then he had his world service offices, which would produce all the material, you know, audio, visual material. And then he had, well, they called them different names over the years as they restructured, but he had his the latest term would have been visiting servants. So they were people who were in touch with some of the higher up people, and they would go out and visit all the communes very regularly to
and
make sure
bring the word
things
of-
were going as they were supposed to, that people were following Berg's instructions. And these local leaders, as we can call them, you know, they were really worshipped as well. You know, they were seen as, wow.
And were they friendly, kind people, or were they intimidating presence when they arrived to check up?
Oh, both.
Right.
You know, they would put that lovely smile on and I am a servant of God, but there was a great authority over people, a control over people, and, you know, it's very simple. You don't like what's going on here, get out.
And were there ever, you mentioned earlier about mouse being washed out, were there ever punishments for people who weren't behaving in the correct way?
Well, for the adults, so as part of the control, you have to remember, due to contraception, families were big.
Mm.
You know, most people had, my parents ended up with 12 kids in the end. And that's not uncommon in the cult. But,
wow.
By this stage, as I was growing up, you know, most families were 8, 9, 10 people already. And you were usually living in a foreign country. So some homes would take the passport, some homes wouldn't. So that wasn't necessarily a means of control. But even if you wanted to leave, what are you going to do?
Mm.
You've got this massive family. You've got no access to significant finances, certainly not enough to fly 10 children and a wife back to mainland Europe, you know, let alone what are you going to do when you get to Europe? You've never had an official job.
Mm.
You've never contributed to a pension or any social thing. You know, you were completely and utterly trapped. And what was your option if you started to complain? Go. But your spouse and your children are staying.
Oh, I see.
So that's, you know, going back to why you destroy the family unit. Because then the wife would be like, I can't give up serving God. You know, if that's what you want, then you leave, but I'm staying with the children. And then the guy would be like, well, obviously I have no choice then. And it worked the other way around too.
And I guess at that point they've disconnected from their parents.
Of course. Mm. You know, you're isolated. You haven't spoken to your parents in 20 years. Of course, there were situations where, you know, people got in touch with their parents and got rescued. You know, there was one situation in Thailand where a man had stayed with the children and the woman went back home. I think she was from the US and came back and kidnapped her children from the cult. There's a documentary about it online. It's quite interesting. But that was rare. Most of the times it was either you stay and you shut up or you go and you lose your family.
So there wasn't a threat of violence or those kind of punishments.
No.
It was much more psychological than that, the control methods.
Yeah. Children, of course, there was a lot of violence towards us.
What, like corporal punishment?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, they strongly believed in spare the rod, spoil the child.
Oh, right, okay.
So there was a lot of very harsh physical discipline. You know, even later on when the first group of children were becoming preteens and teenagers, they were starting to maybe show some signs of rebellions. They set up teen training camps, as they called them, where they got all these teenagers together and, you know, put extra effort into making sure that they were staying on the right path that the cult wanted them to. So they would go through hours and hours. I never went to one. My older brother did. It was hours and hours of being read Bird's doctrines every day. Physical work to, you know, make sure you were good and tired so you're more receptive. In some cases, like in Macau, I believe in the Philippines and in Japan, we now know there were literal forms of torture going on. Horrendous, from isolation to, you know, the silence restriction, but to extreme levels where you couldn't speak for a month to anyone, and you had to walk around with a sign around your neck saying, I am on silence restriction, don't speak to me. You know, there were forms of physical beatings and exorcisms that took place that were just completely beyond the realm of corporal punishments. And that was in the more extreme camps, detention camps, some of them were called. But in the average home, I mean, physical discipline just became part of your daily life, really.
Right. Okay. It's a lot to take in. You know, I mean, every time we go into a new area of it, the things you tell us are just sort of more and more horrifying. When you mentioned earlier about Berg and the fact that he was in hiding for years, ultimately, as soon as he left America, him and his wife and went into hiding. Was he rich? Like, was he in hiding in a mansion somewhere with servants? Or was he in hiding, as we think of, you know, terrorist leaders in hiding, moving around from, you know?
A bit of both, because there was a point where he was looked for by Interpol. He was on their wanted list for prostitution because of flirty fishing.
Okay.
And
when you've just said that, that's so true. As in, I was listening to flirty fishing going, oh, wow, that's a weird thing the cult did.
Yeah.
But it was just prostitution, wasn't it?
I always like to call it what it is, religious prostitution.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Except the poor women weren't even allowed to keep the money.
Yeah.
So, but he traveled under fake IDs, fake passports, him and his surrounding. They moved a lot, country to country, to make sure no one could really ever figure out where they were. only his very, very core circle ever knew where he was or what name he was operating under. But at the same time, he also lived a life of luxury because every home would give, I believe it was about 14% of their income every month.
It's like a tithe kind of thing.
Yes, that was tithe, exactly. And that would apparently go towards the running costs of the whole leadership team and all that. But I mean, we know he always lived in houses with lovely pools, had access to the best food. And as for servants, of course, that was just the cult members. That was their job. So,
okay. So when you, I want to get the order right, actually. So when you'd moved back to France and you're talking about the time when you'd moved back just with your family, was he still alive at this point?
No.
No. So what, so did he die while you were still in Thailand?
We were in Malaysia when he died.
Okay. And you were what age?
I would have been just 10.
10. So quite often in these circumstances, I think when the central leader of a cult, not always, but if they die or pass away or they're arrested or something, it's very hard to maintain it and keep it going and keep the cohesive whole. So how was that presented? Like him dying before the prophecies had been realised that he'd, you said 1990s, he was talking about the Antichrist coming back and stuff. How did they manage to keep the cult together and running as they wanted it to? And who took over from him?
So his wife, Karen Zerb, took over. There was a whole series of letters that came out where Berg had passed the mantle on to her. She was the chosen one to pick up the mantle and become the next leader. But I think essentially, if you look at their entire history, things kind of went downhill after his death.
Okay.
So she did manage to maintain control, mainly through bringing out a lot of her own innovative doctrines and things and, you know, trying to, she tried to really say, hey, I'm not Berg, you know, excite the younger generation of things.
And was she getting messages from God as
well?
Yes, of course. So now she was the...
Yes.
And how many people were in the cult at this point at its height?
At its height, about 10 to 15,000.
God.
All in all, 30,000 people have passed through the group, approximately.
Okay, huge.
At any one time, at its height, it was about 10 to 15,000.
Okay.
And again, about 70% were children.
Okay.
So and a massive population of second generation.
And so she's now saying, you know, I've got a new way of doing it. God's now showing me the new, more, I don't know, what was it? What was the difference when you said she wanted to put her own stamp on it? What was different?
Well, she tried to focus, she tried to eradicate a lot of the practices that Berg had brought in that she knew, because around the time he died, there was a lot of attention from authorities and the media. And she knew that in order for the cult to survive, they would have to kind of turn their back a little bit on Berg. Mm. But again, so what they had to do, for example, for the UK court case. So it was essentially the cult was on trial. They brought in all sorts of witnesses who talked about abuse they had lived through and things like that. And the judge ultimately, he wasn't, the court case was not about the cult officially. So he couldn't do anything about that. It was about custody, but he did say in his ruling, which is hundreds of pages long and very interesting, that he did find that there was systematic abuse across the cult and that it was institutionalized. So the cult, in order to win the custody case, they had to write to the judge renouncing all of Berg's doctrines on child sex and all that, which they did. To win the case.
The custody case for children that were in the cult.
For a child.
A child.
It was a one custody case that turned into the whole cult being on trial in the UK.
Okay.
So they did that letter just to be able to get custody of that kid.
As a cult. Back. So the cult wanted, or was it the parent of the child that was trying to get the kid back? Or was it the cult?
Grandmother was trying to get the kid out.
Right, okay.
The cult spent millions fighting the case.
To keep the child.
Because it became the cult.
Okay, right.
Sort of on trial. So they were forced to renounce Berg's doctrine on that. And of course, right behind that, Zerbe then published another letter to her followers saying, we only had to say that to win the case. You know, all that again. You have to remember that Karen Zerbe, even when Berg was alive, was extremely powerful in the cult. Mm. So like I said, he was an alcoholic for many, many years. And she was really the one running the show most of the time. She's the one who wrote the story of Davidito. She's the one who would take down his words, was heavily involved in the final drafts that would be sent out. But then over time, after Berg's death, she kind of tried to imply that everything was Berg.
Mm.
That, you know, that's the big issue we have now, is that no one's looking at Karen Zerbe when she was so, so involved in everything that happened.
But you were saying earlier that she is still on the run as well, right? She's in hiding. Is that right?
That's right. We know her last name change legally was Catherine Smith, but we have no idea where she is.
Anywhere in the world.
Rumored around Mexico somewhere, but...
So, okay. So you have moved back with your family to France. There's more access to the outside world. You're now how old, sorry?
That point of time, I was about 13.
13, okay. So is this the point in time you start to realize something's up? You know, the outside world is not as horrible as you might have thought, or...
Absolutely, know. Yes. That was the first big shocker for me was, you know, these systemites, as we called them, you know, they seemed to be really nice people. They didn't seem to be evil at all or scary or, you know, and just generally the way the outside world seemed to function just didn't seem wrong to me.
Mm.
And then more and more the way we were functioning seemed wrong to me. And that was around that time in the cult, a lot of SGAs started leaving, second generations. It started with a small handful who left, who were heavily criticized by the cult leader, of course. They were called demons, and, you know, we were always told that really bad things would happen to us if we left the cult. You know, mm-hmm. We'd all become drug addicts and die and get murdered and all sorts of things. So there was a huge fear about leaving, but luckily once the first batch left, it just kind of started a roll. As kids were becoming of age, they were starting to leave, and more and more and more left until pretty much the majority of SGAs left the cult in the end.
Wow.
Over time, because of course each, you know, you had to get to an age where you could legally leave and be independent.
And was that 16 or 18?
18. But I guess it depends on which country you were
sure.
in. Certainly in France, it was 18, yeah.
So was there a specific point in time you sat down with your family and said, look, I'm going to leave?
Yes. Luckily, I had older brothers who had already left.
Right.
So the worst was when you were the first of the family to do it. Yeah. But I had some who had already left, so it wasn't as difficult. But then it was horrible in a way because you knew that you were causing the greatest disappointment you ever could to your parents, who really believed that was the life that you were chosen for, that was your ultimate mission in life, was to grow up to be this person in the end time. It was difficult having that conversation, and even more difficult after you left because you were treated like a backslider or traitor of some sort.
So can you talk us through what it was like to leave? You know, what did that look like? Was it a slow process, or were you suddenly, this is how I've lived my life and now the whole world's opened up to me and I'm living in a flat somewhere? You know, what did it actually mean to leave?
I think the process was over a few years. By the time I got to around 16, 17 years old, I knew I was going to leave when I was 18. I just had to bide my time a bit. It was incredibly scary for me, very, very frightening, because, you know, we'd been told the outside world was a dangerous place, that bad things happened, especially to people who turned their back on God. So, you know, you had all that fear of being punished by God and bad things happening to you. And then from a practical point of view, we really didn't have the knowledge to live in the outside world. You know, we hadn't been brought up to know how to open a bank account or how do you get a job, especially when you've had no formal education. You've been homeschooled your whole life in a very questionable amount of education was given to you that was very strange and not really adequate to get any kind of decent job on the outside. It kind of felt like you were just thrown out there. You know, you wouldn't get any support, financial or practical. from the cult or your family. You were just set, you know, you want to leave, go. And you had to learn very quickly how to survive on your own. I had met someone at that point, so luckily I had somewhere I could live in the early days. But the whole process was extremely difficult, and it was really over a decade at least before I even felt remotely like I was part of society. Mm. Because, you know, it wasn't even just the practical things that I had to learn to do from scratch. It was just the way I was, for example, you know, the way I talked. I used terms that were very strange to outsiders because they were cult lingo and cult terms that we used. So you always kind of felt completely out of place, like you didn't belong. And that was very difficult psychologically.
And would you say to people that you met after a couple of years, you know, would you say, was the cult something that you felt embarrassed and ashamed about, yeah, that you didn't want to talk to new people about? Or was
definitely
it, yeah,
because I think once or twice I had tried and I saw the way people looked at me differently after that. I think now maybe not so much, but back then there was a perception that if you were from a cult, born or recruited into it, you were, you know, a strange person. You were someone who was screwed up and someone who wasn't normal. I think with time now, I've learned to accept that there is a massive difference already between being recruited and being born into. Already, there was no choice. But secondly, I like to prove to people that you can have a past like that and be completely normal. But certainly the first years, very quickly I understood it was going to be a big secret I had to keep. So I had a whole fake story. You know, because people be like, why do you come from such a big family? I'd be like, oh, my parents are really Christian. And why did you grow up abroad? My dad worked for the embassies. I kind of made up this whole fictional past that I'd used to try and get away with the fact that I had a weird accent despite being French. And, you know, just so many things just you had to explain away because you just couldn't tell the truth. Obviously, as I got to a point later where I felt part of society, I then moved on to a big stage of my healing, which was writing my book. And as I was writing that, that's when I started to get a bit more confident about speaking up and realize, you know, this is not my shame to carry. Absolutely not. I had no choice in this. And the fact that I'm still alive right now when so many of my peers aren't, you know, that's something I should be proud of.
And when you say that your peers aren't, because of what? Why are they not?
Well, a lot of ex-members, because, you know, in the cult, there wasn't just physical and sexual abuse. There was, you know, you're talking about entire childhood of psychological and emotional abuse as well. Mm-hmm. And when you get out into the world, you know, it's very, very difficult to try and become part of society when you've grown up in such an alternative lifestyle. It's like being dumped on an alien planet and, you know, and for a lot of ex-members, sadly, a lot turned to addictions. A lot, you know, especially the first ones that left, particularly some of them had to go and get jobs as, you know, strip teasers and things like that, for example, because they had no education. They didn't know how to make money. But a lot of people still did well practically and with jobs and things, but then had so much trauma from their past. And, you know, we never talked about things like mental health in the cult. Mm-hmm. We feared psychologists rather than, you know, seeing that they could be there to help. And a lot of us suffer with depression, with PTSD. And I think back in the days, particularly, there were very few psychologists who were able to help cult members. They just didn't understand. And sadly, you know, we've lost a lot of ex-SGAs, so my peers, to suicide. A lot. So we estimate now there's a minimum of 150, probably closer to 200 and possibly a lot more, because when they leave the cult, often they'll, you know, go and disperse and they never want to have contact with another cult member again. So the true number, I mean, we've been trying to keep some sort of record and we know it's in the hundreds, but, and it's definitely over 100, but it's impossible to say how many. But we still have suicides today. We still have every couple of months, every 3 months, we hear of another one.
And in terms of that and the reasons for it, am I right in thinking that you've you've formed a group, haven't you, to try and bring some of these people to justice. Is that right?
Well, myself and several other ex-SGAs, we got together and formed a group called the COG TFI Survivors. So COG for Children of God, TFI for the Family International. And we decided, you know, we need to do something now because it's been so long. They've been getting away with this. The cult still exists. Karen Zerbe's still out there. There's not even an arrest warrant out against her when there is so much evidence against her that can be easily found online. There's so much evidence given against her in testimony as well, be it from people speaking out to the media or even affidavits that, you know, the FBI and Interpol, for example, they've have many, many files on the cult. They have many, many affidavits on the cult, and yet they've done nothing. Absolutely nothing. And she's just out there living a free life.
In hiding.
Last reported was hiding somewhere in Mexico, but we really don't know where she is. But then, you know, that's something that an enterprise like Interpol or the FBI, they could find her easily if they really wanted to. But it's the fact that they're not even looking that outrages a lot of us ex-members, because we feel like, you know, we've been speaking out for so long and no one's doing anything. And we're being told there are two big factors. So it's the international nature of the crime. So for example, the man who abused me, He was a Filipino national who abused a French national in Thailand. So where do you even start? Plus everyone used fake names in the cult. So I had no idea who he was. Like many people don't have the real identity of their abuser. I did find out who he was. I got a tip off after I went public and my name came out.
Wow.
So I knew exactly which city he lived in Philippines, that he was part of a church, that he had a young child and was married. I got recent photos of him as well.
Really? And did you find his name as well?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
But all I could do was write to the Filipino justice organization, and that went nowhere, of course. So what's my next option? Nothing. And so many of us are in this same position, or there's issues with statute of limitations, which should not exist for sex crimes. That's a big thing we talk about as well. Any crime that happened to a child particularly, there should be no limit on when you can report it, because you know, by the time you're ready emotionally to do so, they just turn around and go, well, it's too late. Should have done that years ago. But we've had two very successful convictions in the UK recently against abusers, not against the cult. But what we're saying as a group is we need the leaders to take responsibility now. We need them to be searched for by Interpol or by the FBI. You know, you're telling us there's an issue with countries and time, but that wasn't an issue with Weinstein. That wasn't an issue with Ghislaine Maxwell. That wasn't an issue with Epstein either. When the media is paying enough attention to something, suddenly it's possible to find these people and bring them to court. And that's what we want, is to raise enough media traction to get someone interested in looking for Karen Zerbe and making her answer for her crimes.
Do you think that it's possible for anyone to join a cult? Not as, you know, not be born into one, but any grown adult, do you think it takes a certain type of personality to be able to be brainwashed into something like that? Or do you think it's possible for anyone to fall into that?
Already, I never use the term join a cult. You're recruited.
Okay.
They're professional recruiters, cults. I think absolutely anyone could be dragged into one, because they're so adept at changing as well. They adapt with times. So for example, right now, they're estimated to be about 1,000 cults who are active in the UK. But they're not going to look like the Children of God or anything like that. A lot of them now are through other things that attract people. They're online communities, yoga, running groups even, I've heard of. They pass under all sorts of different, more modern things that are more attractive to people, and using more modern technology, social media, so that they adapt the way they work all the time, and their front adapts all the time to fit in with whatever is acceptable in society. So it really doesn't take much to be pulled in. I mean, our cult, you had people who were highly educated with PhDs, just like you had drug addicts who joined. You had rich people. You had Fleetwood Mac's guitarist, Jeremy Spencer, who joined and was in for many years.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. All walks of society. I think you just have to have that combination of being at maybe a point in your life where you're searching for something, or you may be a bit dissatisfied, or you need a change, or, you know, maybe there needs to be that little spark. But as far as what kind of person, no, I don't think there's any stereotype.
Mm. And the cult still exists today, as you mentioned. You know, how does it look today in terms of an organization? Is it still doing the big military-style camps, or is it in smaller groups?
So they're much smaller now. I think they're just a couple thousand people, and they call themselves now an online church. Mm. But we don't really know. We know they're still active. We know they're active in many countries still, but they're so secretive about their activities that we don't really know. Though we did hear recently that they were still occasionally recruiting people. So that was interesting for an online community.
Mm. I guess my final question to you is, as someone who's lived a life that's really quite different to most people, you know, what's it taught you? What's the lesson that your life's taught you?
I think predominantly to never give up, because if I give up, I feel like the cult wins.
Mm.
And probably my view of humans in general, you know, never to judge people, because I've seen what trauma and pain does to people, you know, even years down the line later in life. You know, even now there are a lot of ex-members, some of who I know personally, who struggle very much with addiction still, multiple addictions generally, who are constantly feeling suicidal. And it's, I guess that it's made me understand just what actions can do to a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important in general to be very mindful of the way you speak to a child, the way you act with a child, because the repercussions later are, you know, it could have been an experiment for them, but what they did was raise an entire generation of people who struggle every day just to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they have so much pain in them.
And if you could speak to anyone who is listening to this, that's in the position you're in when you'd started to realize something wasn't right and probably had that fear of the realization, what would you say to them?
I would say, don't be scared to make that jump. It is going to be the scariest thing you'll ever do, but there are more and more people out there who will help. There's a lot more awareness now of the impacts of cults, of a cult upbringing or a cult experience. There's a lot more associations out there who are willing to help even practically and you know, with practical things to get you set up and things. And a lot more therapists out there who are trained now to deal with this kind of trauma. So, yeah, I'd say it's scary, but take the leap and get out while you can. Don't give them any more of your life or your time.
Natasha, it's been amazing having you in, and it's a really, really fascinating story. And thank you so much for being so open and telling it so well. We really do wish you all the best. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.